to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm joined today by Sinead McGarry, who is a social worker and highlighting a lot of issues within the current crisis around COVID, about how the government is approaching this, about who's being included, who's not being included. And I think raising some very, very important questions that need to be discussed. Sinead, thank you very much for joining us today on Reboot Republic.
Thanks, Rory.
Happy and I should say, joining us again after the last we had you on before, and it was some great reaction to the whole issue of, I suppose, exclusion and abuse of people and individuals. Sinead, you were saying on, and I'm actually going to read it out, both to embarrass you and to get you going. Your tweet today, which I thought was really, really accurate and very insightful, which you said, the responding to what Stephen Donnelly said, the government closely followed the NFET advice when opening up the country in December. You said that this is why I disagree with those who propose we solely focus on the current situation rather than also assessing how we got here. In the vacuum of meaningful analysis, dangerous and fake news is being spun by the government. Despite the spin, opening hospitality, which serves alcohol, in a country with 1.35 million harmful drinkers and the second highest rate of binge drinking in the world, with known harmful social trends around alcohol use, was a profoundly different choice to extending home visits. Experts in NFET and infectious disease advised against this. Despite the government spin, opinion polls clearly show the public favoured NFET's guidance. These are facts people can forgive. Mistakes, but the Trump revisionism of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party is appalling. The government has prioritised spin over facts, science and truth. We need strong voices to call them out in politics, mainstream media and social media, as their decision-making has cost both lives and quality of life. And their consistent inability to reflect on this will cause more harm. It also appears lessons of the last election were quickly forgotten when voters punished government for their spin on homeless figures and health service and the health service. The public see through the spin. The lack of political integrity in public life is not and should not be a social norm. I think that should be printed out and put on everybody's wall as a reminder of what the need for critical reflection and critical analysis. What made you write that, Sinead?
Well, first of all, I think it's an ongoing sign of my inability to be brief about anything on Twitter. So, there's always multiple thoughts on any of my threads, but I'll work on that. Maybe that'll be a 2021 goal. Look, I suppose, you know, coming from my own background of social work, we're trained in systemic thinking. And I just think there's been an absence of that throughout the pandemic, and not in its entirety. And it's easy to come on and bash politicians and bash government. And we've kind of talked about that before, that everybody is making very difficult choices based on different sources of information. From my perspective, I suppose, I just think that there's that lack of systemic thinking and that lack of joined up thinking. So, for example, if we talk about reopening hospitality, and I've heard some senior ministers talk about, you know, the fact that restaurants opened in various parts of Europe. We need to look at our own context. We need to look at what happens in Ireland, and we need to know, you know, to understand our own known and established social trends around alcohol use. And any of us who've worked within health services, you know, my background is emergency department medicine, social work, for many, many years. And there is a very well established link between, you know, our hospitality sector and, you know, individuals' use of alcohol. So It wasn't of any surprise to see NFET's slide, I think it was 2 days ago, where there was a very clear spike associated with the reopening of pubs and hospitality, sorry, gastropubs and hospitality 10 days previously. And again, that information just doesn't seem to be informing policy, or if it is, it isn't a priority in policy. There are other examples of that. You know, we've talked before about, you know, adult safeguarding and cocooning, but even the decision to cocoon, you know, 32,000 people in our 575 nursing homes, that's a huge decision, and it was made, you know, with very good intentions based on public health advice and to protect people living within those nursing homes. But it ignored the fact that we know that there are known risks. So we know in 2019, there were 711 concerns from HICWA about the quality of care in nursing homes. And we know that there was 159 concerns to safeguarding social workers. We know in just one HSC catchment area in Kildare, Dublin and Wicklow, that there were 1,000 cases reported to the HSC about concerns about the quality of care, safeguarding concerns related to people living in institutions in that area that were never investigated before we made a policy decision to cocoon people into those nursing homes, into the care of care staff without the protective eyes of family, or without thinking creatively about saying, if we have to do this as a short-term measure, we need to be aware of that social trend and we need to plan as to how we can get families back in safely. And unfortunately, that hasn't happened. It has happened elsewhere in Europe, but it hasn't happened in Ireland. So for me, it's very much around, you know, you can pick your issue, and whether it's domestic violence, whether it's the fact that now we have children, you know, out of school. We're hearing a lot in relation to the impact on leaving certs at the moment. And I think I'm late to the news this evening, but I believe schools aren't reopening now. But, you know, there's a whole other category of children at risk who rely on schools for security and stability as much as for education. And it's often a way that they can seek help or that their well-being is monitored. And again, that just there's certain cohorts that seem to receive very little attention in terms of policy making. And I think we've talked previously about voices at the table and the expertise that those voices bring. And unfortunately, we're looking at this through a very narrow prism. And that's continued throughout the pandemic. So what might have been understandable and, you know, from my perspective, forgivable in March, April, May, up until June of last year, the lack of response from government is becoming increasingly difficult for me to understand. And the lack of systemic thinking is having a profound effect, really, on certain pockets of society.
And in that, I think it's a very important, you know, frame and you know, description you're putting on that lack of systemic thinking, and the lack of, you know, kind of taking into account. So, and it does seem to me, all right, that there's these like blanket decisions with almost very little actual planning or thinking around nuances or how, you know, what are the responses. And if you take, for example, you're talking about, you know, those three things you mentioned there, you know, the nursing homes, children, you know, who are, you know, rely, as you say, on the school system in terms of safety, in terms of interaction, and then domestic violence. What would you do differently, or what would you do additionally now, okay, well, to address
first of all,
those?
What I should say in relation to domestic violence is that there are positives within this as well. We have had a phenomenal response from the Gardaí and from domestic violence services in terms of having a coordinated response. So there's been a very clear strategy, and there's been a lot of kind of media messaging in relation to it. And while the risks have increased during cocooning, and certainly have, I mean, if I had, you know, if I was in government, I would certainly not have been reopening hospitality with the social lens of the groups that are going to go back into high risk situations, such as women living in domestic violence situations, such as children living in homes where neglect or known harm is occurring. And there may be little information, early stages of investigation. Those people are all now cocooned in their family homes. They're out of reach of services, and we need to be really honest about that. You know, there's the domestic violence services have certainly given a good messaging in terms of how people can come out and access help. But TUSLA have been very honest about their ability to get into certain family homes has been limited. They talked last year about how at-risk referrals or notifications of child abuse and child protection concerns dropped completely during lockdown. So, you know, those children are now out of reach, and we know that has happened in other jurisdictions as well. So I suppose in terms of going back to that systemic thinking piece, when we decide to reopen, those groups need to be at our priority, and we need to make decisions that are safest for society to keep as much of civil society moving and operational as we can. So to hear the Taoiseach or the Taoiseach say, well, people needed a break, people needed to go out and people needed to socialise, you know, I mean, who doesn't love it? Who doesn't miss it? Who isn't mourning and lamenting the loss of our lives? But, you know, our rights as people who are not living in those situations do not supersede the rights of those people to live in as risk-free a society as possible. And I suppose for me, it's the hierarchy of priorities for government. And obviously, as a social worker, I'm always going to go to the people who are living in the risk or the marginalized communities. Mm. But that is a way to govern. That is an option, where instead of pointing fingers and pointing at restaurateurs or, you know, the Vintners Association and people getting kind of othering everybody, so everybody is given a label, recognizing that all of us work in a community where we have more, and work and live in a community where we have more than one role. So the restaurateur might be the person living in a domestic violence situation, or might be the patient who requires care next week. And we need to start to think about our, you know, how we operate as a community, how we support each other in our community, how we identify the people who are most vulnerable, and how we develop policy responses to them. In relation to the nursing home piece, I mean, you know, you asked what would we do differently. We would be at the table. We would be asking government, how are you going to increase and enhance safeguarding protection if you remove family visits? We wrote to Stephen Donnelly, Mary Butler, and we wrote to the acting CMO, Ronan Glynn, in September, and we asked them to look at the successful models that have been piloted and have led to the rollout of visiting pods across Europe to allow families to site people. Now, so much of the discussion has been around human distress that has been caused by the lack of visiting into nursing homes, and it's huge. And it's, you know, it's killing people. It's death by secondary COVID, if you like. You know, it's the isolation is immense and the distress is immense. But there's another role that families play, and all social workers will tell you. I've spent my career working in hospitals where I have witnessed excellent care from nursing homes, and the majority of nursing homes offer very good care, but I have consistently investigated concerns of low quality care, neglect and abuse. And so much of that information comes from the family and the concerns about the quality of care. And social workers, and we've written to the minister about this, we've highlighted the known evidence in relation to this within our nursing home sector. We've written consistently through the pandemic about it to absolutely no response on that issue. We haven't had any response, acknowledgement of the concerns. Family groups have been writing about it. And we would certainly be looking for enhancing access in a safe way, not in a, you know, let's ignore public health advice here, but talking to our public health service to see, you know, can we do what other countries have done, which is introduce, Germany had up to 2 visits a day during lower rates of community transmission, which were still higher than ours. And they were managing it safely without outbreaks. In Wales, they introduced a €3 million fund for visiting pods for every nursing home. In Scotland, they were looking at outdoor heated gardens. There's lots of creative ways, if you work with people from design and innovation industries, to solve the problem. But first of all, you have to see it as a problem, and you have to see people's rights as important. And again, that has been challenging. And I would say, to be fair to our government, there are pockets of good practice. Anne Rabbitt, the minister with responsibility for disability services, is doing really good work in terms of keeping those services open and communicating with families. In terms of, you know, our links with Stephen Donnelly and Mary Butler, we haven't had any response in relation to the concerns that have been raised and that I'm raising there now. And even in terms of, families themselves. So this gives a really practical example, and I hope it kind of illuminates what I'm talking about, because I was following on Twitter just concerns that families were raising specific to visiting and specific to when they were trying to get into nursing homes in accordance with the current government guidance, which currently says window visits are safe, which currently says that on the basis of compassionate grounds, you can have a 1-hour visit every 2 weeks in level 5. But families were having significant concerns about this, to getting nursing homes to work with them around their rights at level 3 and now again at level 5. And haven't had any response from government in relation to those concerns. When asked about this on prime time, Minister Butler was asked by Mary McCallan, what would you do if nursing homes don't adhere to the visiting guidance that the government have put out? And her response was, I would be surprised and appalled. Well, now we know that it's happening. And now we know the government isn't acknowledging that. So a group of social workers actually have been working, to advocate on this issue. We ended up drawing up some guidance for families. I put something together. I gave it to a group of families who are an advocacy group who are working on the same issue. And 30 families who had received no to visiting received yes after receiving that guidance. Now, are we really leaving it to volunteer social workers to promote and support the rights of families and residents to see each other? And I just think that's, it's beyond the pale of what we want as a compassionate society.
It definitely is, highlights, that absence of what you described there, a compassionate society, that it seems incredible. But of course it's not incredible at all, given that, you know, we see it on many levels. But it's what you described, it's like a piecemeal, you know, as you say, there's pockets that of the system, you know, that work, or, you know, parts of departments or parts of the HSC, but it's not across the board. And part of, you know, the fundamental problem is that people aren't viewed as rights holders. Everybody isn't viewed as having human rights to care, to support, that it's still, we're still operating on a not even charity approach, but this sort of, it is to a certain extent, you know, if you make a bit of noise, we'll do something about it. But if you don't, well, go off in the corner there and survive.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, regardless, I'm talking about nursing homes, if it's a service, a residential service for disability or mental health, has the history of our state not taught us that care settings should not operate behind closed doors? So we have the historical context, we have the expertise and people willing to work with government. And I don't think for one moment that if I sat and I was able to explore these concerns with either, you know, senior civil service or ministers, that we couldn't come and find some of the solutions and provide some guidance to residents or families, bearing in mind they haven't received anything in writing around any of their rights in this issue. We just don't communicate. So it's finding ways to change the culture.
And does this differentiate across HSE provided homes and private ones, private operators? Is there an issue of public and private here or not, or does that not come into it?
I mean, I had a kind of a briefing with that family group that I was talking about, and there's certainly issues in relation to accessing rights in both. Now, again, I need to, you know, reassure people listening, if they have somebody residing in a nursing home, I'm always very conscious about that. You know, good care obviously exists, and excellent care exists, but this, I suppose, the culture that I'm talking about, you know, where rights aren't seen as important or viewed as a priority by the service provider, and the power then sits with the service provider, also exists. And we have created a nursing home sector. And again, our current minister, Mary Butler, has inherited this. And I'm very conscious of that. She's inherited a sector where 80% of our residents live in private residential places. The HSC has no clinical oversight or very limited regulatory oversight of the nursing homes. You know, the chief inspector in HICWA has been blatantly and bluntly and wrote a fantastic opinion piece for anyone who wants to go back and look at it in the Examiner, highlighting why it took 3 months to close a nursing home with known and serious risks this summer in Listowel. You know, there was really, really poor practices. People later died of COVID. Practices that weren't made known to residents and families at the time, because again, do we even tell people about what's happening in their own homes in a timely fashion? It appears not. So, you know, I suppose within all of that, the need to intervene and to work in a new way and think in a new way about these issues is just imperative, but the willingness to do it isn't there at the moment. So it goes back to that point, I suppose, about changing culture and moving things on in a new way. But to start that, people have to be at the table. And we need to ask, again, as a social worker, and I ask it as a social worker, but I also ask it as a citizen of the state. Social workers are the only trained health and social care professionals with expertise in human rights and challenging of social injustice. Why have we not been involved in any of the pandemic response planning? I mean, why wouldn't you want that lens or expertise there, particularly when we bring solutions?
Why do you think it is the case?
Well, I often say, and it's funny because even within hospitals, sometimes social workers are the troublemakers, in the sense of we'll come to the care planning meeting, maybe with the professionals, and everybody has a discharge plan, and we'll say, actually, no, the family carer needs a bit of support around this, that, or the other. But when you actually work with us, you know, we integrate very well into teams and we find solutions, and we find long-term solutions. We overcome that kind of short-term thinking that Cleanan Kellogg often talks about, in terms of where sometimes we just go for the easy solution, but social work brings that broader systemic lens. I don't think it's necessarily an exclusion other than the fact that, you know, it's a predominantly female profession. Most social workers go into social work to stay in professional practice because they enjoy it. And I suppose the governance structures within the Department of Health and the HSC don't lend to us having a voice at senior management level. So, for example, you've got, you know, the Chief Office of Nursing within the Department of Health. You don't have anything like that for social work. You have in other jurisdictions, you don't have here. But again, the cost of that and the price of that as a social worker and as a citizen is that the kind of the lens that we look at things is missing from the table. And we don't bring all the solutions. You know, we're part of a team, but we the solutions that we bring are vital to people's well-being. And it enhances the kind of care that we provide. It takes people out of the biomedical. At the moment, nursing home residents are viewed very much as frail, vulnerable, need of protection. Social work brings, they're part of our family, they're vital parts of our community, they have a vital need for connection. And we can do both. We can protect and we can connect. But if you don't involve us, and if you don't involve other people who work like us, and if you don't involve families, and if you don't talk to residents, you're just going to provide that protection, which will keep people alive, but it doesn't give them a quality of life.
And it does seem that, you know, I think that, you know, describes it very well in terms of, you know, being advocates and bringing that human rights lens is actually really, really essential. And, you know, not just in regard to nursing homes, but, you know, as you say, in terms of hospitals, in terms of child welfare, mm-hmm. mental health, you know, all those issues, you would think that, you know, social work would be in the decision making, that if we're really taking serious the and government is really taking serious the idea that we want to protect people's well-being and mental health, then the people who are advocating and who know the situations should be represented within that decision making.
Absolutely. And I also think it's a sign, I probably sent a really lengthy tweet about this recently as well, but, you know, it's the individualistic nature of our society now. And almost we are, you know, when we talk about mental health, it relates to one-on-one clinical kind of setting. That's what springs to people's minds, or else that level kind of one where it's, you know, looking after your general well-being, exercising, things, you know, connecting with people. But in terms of doing things at group level or community level, like I heard of a lovely project today from one of the principal social workers I was talking to, of a mental health service where the occupational therapist and social worker were so concerned about the quality of, I suppose, the experience that people living within a mental health residential setting were having over the last year, and that they set up a physical group. Everybody used PPE, and they set up a physical group, and they used that the opportunity to physically connect in a room, and it was just a fantastic success. So not necessarily the content wasn't any different than what people have been delivering, receiving remotely or through, you know, through technology, but actually gathering people together was really, really important. And again, that's the sort of thing that, you know, health social care professionals tend to bring to the table. It's kind of creative and different ways of working with people that are equally as important, but it broadens that kind of lens and thinking about mental health. So it's not necessarily just what you deliver, it's how you deliver it is really important. You know, there is the one other example I'd say is that, you know, we worked on a liaison model as well. And this is what I'm talking about in terms of representation and what we're missing out on. And it's we worked on a piece of work around how to communicate with people in living in residential care and their families and support them, particularly through COVID. Sold it up and down the country to HSC, to the Department of Health, and nobody, much to my dismay, nobody came running to congratulate us on our brilliance. But we blogged about it, we got it out there, and it's been picked up by the Economist Intelligence Unit, and it's going to form part of their global report. Now, I say that not to say, oh, you know, we weren't, this piece of work was ignored at home and has been picked up, you know, somewhere else and at you know, a significant level and will have some global impact. But there's something that's just so, so destroying that, you know, almost it'll have to go outside of Ireland before it'll be valued. It'll impact and change people's lives elsewhere, hopefully, for the better in some ways, small ways. But we're not having the same impact here because we don't have the voice, because we don't have representation, because we're not at the table. And, you know, that's the piece that, and I suppose we keep coming back to, it's culture change and representation and systemic thinking. There are my three things. If we could, my 2021 goals, there'll probably be lots of long tweets about those three things this year. Aren't we all lucky?
And yes, absolutely. Looking forward to lots more. But that culture change that you talk about, just to finish up, that the, you know, when you say it is valuing, and we talked about this the last time as well, the lack of valuing of social work and why there's a lack of valuing. And is it in part because, you know, we haven't, the HSC hasn't seen this, you know, valued the actual role, or not just the HSC, but the Department of Health previously. And, you know, our state doesn't value the social work because it is, in a way, this advocacy role, that it's not simply providing us, you know, as of course it is providing a service, but it's not in that sense. It doesn't fit this clear box of, you know, administering a role within the health system, that it's like, it's seeing as, you know, as again, others refer to, it's not this biomedical approach. It's actually a broader human holistic. And that also, of course, challenges that system, and that there is still a fundamental problem in this country, that our state is insecure about itself, unable to accept challenge, unable to expand, and ultimately does not view its citizens as rights holders.
Absolutely. I mean, organizational culture is huge. And again, should go back to say that there are pockets of fantastic culture. That example I cited earlier of the social worker and the OT, that would have been sanctioned in terms of, you know, working safely within public health. And they were pushing probably the boat in terms of what people are doing at the moment at frontline. So there is really good examples of good organizational culture. But in terms of when you query, where's the profile of social work within this culture? You know, safeguarding social workers have to investigate HSE services at times and the quality of care within them. And we have put in a submission to the Oireachtas Committee on Health in terms of highlighting what social workers have fed back to us about the organisational culture they encounter when they raise examples of safeguarding concerns within HSE services. And it's not positive. And there's minimising of the findings of social workers. There's minimising of the concerns that they have. There's attempts to kind of explain away. And there's not necessarily sometimes there's kind of a limiting of the social work role. And look, that's against the wider backdrop of what the government provides in terms of if adults are at risk within our community, we don't have fantastic legislation, et cetera, et cetera. But when you go back to that piece of it, challenging organisations, we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to do. It's even hearing voices, you know, retweeted their the Scottish government produced a podcast there in relation to, funded a study there in relation to the experiences of families of people who are living in a wide range of residential settings. I think the last one was a nursing home, so they're looking at a couple of residential settings. We're not looking for those voices or those experiences during lockdown in this area. And I suppose, you know, Rory, you talk about always finishing on a positive note or whatever. There are good examples of really good practice across our health and social care services. And the HSC gets knocked an awful lot, but it also delivers really good work in lots of individual areas. But it isn't consistent. The culture within our health and social care services is not always conducive to delivering rights, and it's often not conducive to delivering a rights-based service. We know that you only have to look at how, you know, patient complaints in hospitals, et cetera, are dealt, the length of time people are left waiting for a response. We don't respond well in those scenarios, but we do have the expertise. And I am a firm believer in, you know, I suppose using our voices, and whether it's ourselves as a female dominated profession in social work or our colleagues in our female colleagues in public health medicine who are having a similar challenge in terms of being heard and resourced and supported. I think there's lots of really exciting things happening to kind of support that kind of expertise being heard and promoted. And even, you know, vehicles like this, it's just so important that we're able to find the discussion. And I'd like, suppose my final point would be, why aren't we hearing this in mainstream media?
Mm.
You know, why are my tweets seeming, you know, what if I tweet something like that? You know, sometimes I get messages afterwards saying that's really thought provoking. These are, you know, to social workers, I'm not saying anything new here that hasn't been said by my colleagues across Ireland. And I suppose it's not a lens that we hear in mainstream media. And there's a lot of voices that are missing from mainstream media.
Yeah.
So, more of this.
More of this, absolutely, Sinead. And hopefully you will get on, and the voice will be there. And I think that hopefully this is, I know it is, raising awareness, you know, of the lens that social work brings and the role that it plays, and that a really important role of the human rights frame, the advocacy frame, and, you know, highlighting the issues that are affecting our most vulnerable in society. And I think that, you know, as that understanding grows, hopefully that will add pressure. And not just your voice will be there, but the voice, as you say yourself, of those in the, you know, the residential settings, their voice will be heard and obviously accounted for in decision making. So Sinead McGarry, thank you so much for joining me again on Reboot Republic.
Thanks a million, Rory.
And yeah, we'll have you back again soon, hopefully, if we haven't scared you away.
Well, I'll always have something to rant about, so yeah.
No, it's a lot more than ranting, Sinead, a lot more than ranting. No, please keep them coming, and people can follow you on Twitter if they want, at Sinead McGarr, isn't that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, your Twitter handle.
I'll check my own handle.
It's at Sinead McGarr, I'm really sure. But yeah, no, check it out for lots of really interesting analysis from the social work lens. And so, yeah, best of luck, Sinead. And as always, remind listeners, please, if you can, become a patron. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a patron, support us to keep putting out these podcasts, whatever you can, each month. Please support us. We know you're getting a lot out of the podcasts. We're really, really enjoying the and find it, you know, very fulfilling to be bringing to you the frontline voices, the expertise, the different analysis that will bring about, we believe, a republic of equality, as opposed to inequality, should I say. So thank you, everyone, and talk to you soon.